Welcome to Camp Constitution Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. The show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and rebroadcast on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. You can also hear this on Podomatic.com. Just put in Camp Constitution and you come up with our account, as well as YouTube and IPMNation.org every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. It's brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. And this year's camp is in the Berkshires of Massachusetts from August 5th to the 11th. And please check our website, campconstitution.net. And we have a guest on the line, and I want to introduce Professor David, is it Supper?
Super.
Super. Thanks for being on, David. Can you tell listeners a little bit about your background, and then we get into the Article 5 convention issue?
Certainly. I'm a professor of law at Georgetown University. I got my start teaching law at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, and I've taught at some other schools. I teach a number of subjects, including constitutional issues.
So you're Washington Lee. Now, you have been an outspoken opponent of the Article 5 convention. What brought you to that conclusion?
I think our Constitution is something very special. It's what makes this country like no other on the planet, and it frightens me that people are willing to throw that away.
You had an article in the Denver Post recently, about a week ago. Can you talk a little bit about that article?
Yes. Resolutions that were being considered there were from a liberal group called Wolfpack
that wants to have
a constitutional convention to reconsider Citizens United and campaign finance reform. And the point that I and my co-author made is that anyone who thinks they know what any constitutional convention is going to do are kidding themselves. Once you have a convention, it's going to be wide open, and the things that you thought would never be at risk may be thrown out the window in a flash. So there it's liberals, and some other places it's people saying themselves as conservatives, but it's really all the same. If you call an Article 5 convention, everything is up for grabs.
That's interesting, too, because there are lots of issues that are left-right. You know, there usually isn't any other way to look at it, but this is a unique issue. We have people on both sides of the spectrum, ideological spectrum, that both support and oppose it. And by the way, we've discussed this a lot on our show in the last 3 years, but just for the sake of those who might be new to the show, can you just say what an Article 5 convention is? Or actually explain the Article 5 process, and then which includes the other way to amend the Constitution.
Sure. The convention that was written in Philadelphia in 1787 included Article 5, which provides two ways to change it. One way, which is the only way that's ever been used, is for Congress to send an amendment to the states. It takes a two-thirds vote in both chambers of Congress. Then they send it out to the states, and if three-quarters of the states ratify the amendment, then it gets added to the Constitution. That's how every amendment we've had up to this point was promulgated. But there is another procedure under which states can ask Congress to call a new constitutional convention, a new convention that can propose amendments to the Constitution. And of course, an amendment can include a complete rewrite. We've never done that before. I think it was proposed actually in the first Congress, and the number one opponent of doing that was James Madison, who through one convention and was scared to death of what might be involved.
Yeah, there were two two applications before Congress, the new Congress under the convention. I mean, under the new Constitution actually sat. It was New York and Virginia. And James Madison wrote this famous letter to, I guess it was a friend, George Tuberville, where he said that he would shudder at the thought of another convention. And also John Hancock, at that time he was governor of Massachusetts, and he actually sent out a letter to the various states saying that he appreciates the sentiment of the states that support one, but he was strongly against one as well. And there were many others that didn't, and in fact, we never had one, and as you said, for some reason, all these years, we've never had a convention. Now, there's been numerous applications, and As you said earlier, too, and as the Constitution is clear, it says that the purpose is to propose amendments, plural, and there is absolutely nothing in the Article 5 that says it could be limited to a single amendment or a single topic. And because your article pointed out that when Congress proposes an amendment, it's one amendment, or like the Bill of Rights, it would be 10, but each one is voted up and down for, on its merit. They don't just take the 10 at once. I think there were, weren't they 12 amendments initially, and they ratified 10?
I believe so. Couple just didn't initially make it through. One made it through many years later.
Yeah, the 27th, which I thought was very interesting because it was in sort of constitutional cyberspace, if that's the right word for it. And it was, what, 1991 that was actually passed, you know, all those years later.
Yeah, I believe so.
It had to do with the pay raise, which I actually think it was a sound amendment. It said that Congress can vote themselves a pay raise, but they can't get it until the next election, until their next session of Congress, which means the constituents will now say, hey, do you really think we should vote for these people after they gave themselves this? No, I'm not against pay raises per se. But when Congress, if I was an employee and I wasn't getting the job done, it would be preposterous of me to expect my boss to give me a pay raise. And as an employee, I'm not able to give myself a pay raise. So, you know, Congress has to face reelection. And you also, in your article, you did point out the fact that big money has a lot to say in politics. So when supporters of an Article 5 will say, well, what's your solution? What is your solution? What do you use to counter that?
My solution is that a great deal of what needs to be done can be done through other ways, maybe through proposing amendments through the usual process. But a lot of the things that people complain about can be done with ordinary laws, and some of them can be done just by adhering to the Constitution we have right now. I find it very strange that people say, well, we need a constitutional convention because people aren't following the Constitution.
That's right.
Well,
that's right.
If the problem is they're not adhering to the current one that has the standing of James Madison and George Washington, why ever would we think that they would adhere to a new one? If the problem is enforcement, let's enforce.
People on the conservative side, I sometimes put that – in quotation marks, you know, whatever that means today, I'm not, you know, there's a definition, but it's been misdefined so much, we're not even sure what that means anymore. But they're calling for a balanced budget amendment, which actually, at first view, sounds reasonable, and term limits. Of course, if the Constitution was adhered to, we probably would have balanced budgets, but I looked at the proposed balanced budgets, and there's always an escape clause. And the escape clause makes it more dangerous than an unbalanced budget. One of the escape clauses is in the time, what the exception is in time of war, and I don't think too many people of sound mind want to have a war, so they can have an unbalanced budget. The other one is a state of national emergency. Now, you're a constitutional attorney. Can you? I've read the Constitution, 7 articles, 27 amendments. I don't see the term national emergency in that. So if an amendment like that was passed, we would be in we're already in a national emergency. It's been 11 of them, and I think since 1978. But it would give no incentive for Congress to ever get out of a national emergency, and it also would give legitimacy to the concept of a national emergency. It would make it constitutional. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's taking something that people made up out of thin air and giving it the status of our highest law.
That's right. So that makes it – that makes the solution more dangerous than the problem. And my opinion on the term limits is our founders gave us term limits at the ballot box, frequent elections, and that's really the hallmark of a free country when every 2 years Congress, the House, is up for total reelection and one-third of the Senate, and every 4 years the president, and then you get the state elected officials as well every 2 years in some state. And it's interesting, some states do have term limits and have balanced budget amendments, but it doesn't seem to have any effect on the state's economic policies. They seem to circumvent these balanced budget amendments and continue to go in debt.
The states that have strong finances are states that have electorates that demand strong finances. You can't get around that. If you hire people who are irresponsible to be your officials, you will get irresponsible public policy.
Yep. One of the things that I marvel at, a lot of the people at the state level say that we have to rein in the out-of-control federal government. And you look at the state governments, and they're a little out of control as well. And as our friend Publius Hulda says, that state officials have been collaborating with the federal government for over 100 years, and they like taking the money. And, you know, when I testify, I usually testify in New Hampshire or Massachusetts and in Maine on this, and these are all the states where I work. They say, what's your solution? I say, well, the first one is stop taking the money. If you don't like federal control, stop taking the money. If you don't take the money, they can't control you. And it seems to me it's almost like they want to go back to the constituents and sound like they're trying to lower taxes or get their hands around it. And it look, you know, it's almost like cosmetic superficiality. That so I proposed this Article 5 convention for a balanced budget amendment, but I don't think it's going to go through. But at least I'm trying. Meanwhile, they're part of the problem. They're supporting big government. They're supporting unbalanced budgets, and on and on.
Yeah, it's a free vote, and you hear this in state after state across the country. The state legislators say, oh, it's a free vote. It isn't going to affect anything. I don't have to make hard choices, and if I cast this vote, then I won't be held accountable for what I'm doing on state law that actually is going to take effect. It's very irresponsible.
That's right. The other thing is that the supporters of an Article 5 convention will say, and I believe that there are a lot of very sound people. I have some friends that on the other side. In fact, I'm at a homeschool convention in Worcester, Massachusetts, and one of someone I knew from years ago, he actually gave a presentation on the subject in favor of one on a workshop, you know. So, you know, but we're friends. I've known this fellow for a long time, and I believe he's very sincere. I don't think he's doing it because he's getting paid to do it. He believes that this will be the remedy. But one of the things they tell us is that there's no way that even if some crazy amendments, and whatever that means, that's a subjective term. But even if there's some crazy amendments that pass this convention, there's no way that three-fourths of the states will ever ratify these bad amendments. Can you address that?
I wish that were true, but there's some real problems there. Number one, there's nothing that says they can't package these things together in a way that's very attractive. We call it log rolling. So we put something in with dangers that may not be obvious together with something that sounds very attractive, something that's packaged as supporting our military or something that's packaged as doing something else that everybody seems to want, and it becomes very, very hard for people to vote it down. The other concern is that we don't know that it will take three-quarters of the states to ratify. That's what Article 5 says right now, but the Philadelphia Convention in 1787 disregarded the ratifying rules that they inherited from the Articles of Confederation, and there's a real danger that this convention will say that any amendments are effective as to the states ratifying as soon as half the states do it, or as soon as two-thirds of the states do it. And if that happens, the other states can say, oh, but you're violating the Constitution. But if they're ignored, there's not much they can do. They can secede, I suppose. But if the pattern of states that are ratifying and not is a patchwork across the country, and the states that have ratified want to go ahead, I think the other states are going to be stuck.
Yeah, I believe that's a legitimate concern because the Articles of Confederation was pretty clear. It said that several states, and that meant all the states, had to approve. In fact, Rhode Island did not attend, and they sent a letter to the convention saying, basically, no matter what you folks do, it ain't going to happen unless we approve. And that probably was one of the reasons why they said, let's change the mode of ratification. So, and they looked at themselves as almost a sovereign body that that met, and they got. I think there were nine states that restricted what they were supposed to do, just simply amend the Articles of Confederation. But they didn't consider those resolutions binding upon their – it's simply we're having this convention, so the state said, yeah, we're sending these folks, but it didn't seem to have the power to tell them what to do. And I think a lot of folks think that somehow state legislators will call the shots. So, in other words, the delegates will be nothing more than doing the bidding of state legislators.
Well, that's more wishful thinking. The only precedent we have in Philadelphia 1787 tells us otherwise. And what actually happened in the ratification process of the Constitution is very instructive. There were strong Federalist and strong Anti-Federalist groups in most of the states. And in New York State, for example, there's a pretty good evidence that the Anti-Federalists, the people opposed to the Constitution, probably had a majority. But enough other states ratified that the leaders of the Anti-Federalist group decided that they were stuck, and they acquiesced to ratification because they thought the Constitution was going to happen anyway, even though they strongly opposed its provisions.
Mm-hmm.
That could happen again very easily.
And I think it's important to address the issue of the convention itself. There are some people that believe there's some kind of guidelines already there that they say, well, there have been numerous gatherings over the years, so there's precedent. To me, that's not reassuring, because I know that Congress has tried to pass laws. So at least at some point in the history of Congress, the members of Congress believed that they had some type of ability to control a convention. I know in 1979, the Senate Subcommittee on the Judiciary held hearings, and I actually have a set, and I'd be happy to send it to you. I put it back in print, Kemp Constitution Press. I've got one copy left, and it's fast. It's about 1,200 pages, and there's a lot of testimony. I think Professor Lawrence Tribe is in there from Harvard way back in 78, and people on both sides of the spectrum. But that's the first time, I think, I heard the expression "bar the door" from a convention, and so I'd be happy to send you a copy. I think it'd be very helpful, you know, to you.
I would love to see it. That would be very kind.
Yeah. So if you want to, you shoot me an email. Give me a mailing address, and I'll send it to you. So what can you say about that? What laws are in effect? What right now controls the convention?
Absolutely nothing. The only thing that can control a convention, even in principle, is Article 5, and Article 5 says nothing about this. So will we have one person, one vote, or will we have one state, one vote, or will we have
That's something else? Electoral vote, too. That might be another consideration.
Absolutely. Will we have the delegates chosen by popular vote, or will they be appointed by the state legislatures? If they're appointed by the state legislatures, will the majority party appoint the whole delegation, or will they have it proportionate to the representation in the state legislature? When the convention meets, who sets the agenda? How many votes does it take to propose an amendment to the states? What do you do about log rolling? Are you going to allow people to put politically attractive things in with their politically dodgy amendments? There are so many questions, not one of which we know the answer to. These so-called precedents, none of them were Article 5 conventions. If the advocates want to have a meeting of the states, fine. No problem with that. But that's very different than a body that would have the power to rip up our most fundamental law. All of their precedents either occurred before the Constitution was promulgated, in which case, of course, it couldn't damage the Constitution, or they were explicitly not Article 5 conventions and had no legal authority to change the Constitution.
You know, one of the conventions I bring up is the Hartford Convention, and that's something the Article 5 supporters don't want to hear, because thankfully they were talking about secession. They were concerned the New England states were suffering under the embargo, and a lot of them said, let's secede. And thankfully, cooler heads prevailed, and it didn't happen. I also bring up the secession conventions, where some of the southern states had their conventions, and they seceded from the Union. So so conventions go either way. And they also talk about, they haven't been using this lately, because folks on our side have done the research, and they'll say, well, states have conventions on a regular basis. There's been, I don't know, several hundred state conventions. And they'll say that nothing dramatic has come out of a state convention. And, of course, a state convention isn't an Article 5 convention. It's really totally different. But I've learned in the last couple of years that some dramatic things have happened. For example, Montana had a state convention in 1972, and they created a new constitution. And I was reading a fascinating book about black patriots of the Revolutionary War, and learned that in the 1840s, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania had a convention and disenfranchised blacks. And they had some, there were still some veterans, a few veterans from that war, you know, the Revolutionary War, that were, you know, they were in their 90s or what have you, and they were testifying, say, you know, we shed blood on the battlefield and now we can't vote, and it didn't make any difference. And there's numerous other examples that states have definitely made some profound changes, or at least tried to.
Yes, and state constitutional conventions have all been held in the shadow of the guarantee clause of the federal constitution. So if a state had a convention and tried to establish a dictatorship or a monarchy, the federal constitution doesn't allow that.
That's
there
right.
are no similar fallbacks if an Article 5 convention goes off the rails.
That's right. Now, I remember I was testifying against a Wolfpack resolution. This was a few years ago. And they mentioned, you know, big money out of politics. And when I got up there, I said, you know, I'm not a big advocate of big money in politics necessarily. I believe that, you know, if I formed a political action committee and, you know, I said I'm doing this for the purpose of whatever issue, and I was able to get people to donate money to me or to the cause. And, you know, and I said, look, I'm going to I know there's two candidates running for an office here, and I like this guy. I know how the super PACs work. They can't physically give money, but they can run ads, you know, on issues and what have you. And sometimes big money doesn't always win. And it's just like the New York Yankees and the Red Sox don't win the World Series every year, no matter how big their payroll is. Sometimes big money doesn't win. And you're familiar with Professor Larry Lessig out of Harvard?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Do you know him personally?
Not well, no.
So, yeah, I was at that Harvard event 2011 in September that he and Mark Meckler hosted. I'm trying to get my train of thought here on Larry Lessig is a big advocate of getting money out of politics. He says that we need a convention to do this. But he set up a May Day PAC, a PAC he called May Day. And he's doing the same thing that he's against. And I'm kind of scratching my head. And he raised a few million bucks in a short time. And he supported certain candidates, and the only candidate that he supported that won was a Republican in it was a safe seat. I can't think of his name. I think it was in South Carolina. And so there was one person he backed. Well, he didn't officially back him, but he was obviously a Jim Rubens, and he put a lot of money. They spent a lot of money in New Hampshire pushing Article 5, and they still didn't have any success. In the last cycle, February, their resolution was rejected almost unanimously in committee, as well as the Convention of States also was rejected 17-1. So my contention is that there's lots of money that the Article 5 supporters are spending for this.
It's a very strange notion. Of course, if we have a convention, that's going to be like Congress many times over, and everybody is going to be spending money to get what they want on that. The delegates to the convention are likely to be state legislators who've appointed themselves, many of whom want to move on up in politics. And I think we have a lot of grounds to be concerned about that. But these so-called purists about keeping money out of politics, as you say, are a little selective.
I'm glad you brought just something else. When you mentioned that state legislators may serve as delegates to a convention, and I brought this up at a few hearings, and I said, oh, that's impossible. But there's nothing in the Constitution that would restrict members of Congress to serve as delegates. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
That's right. Now, they can't serve as members of the executive committee. That's forbidden. But there's nothing stopping them from being members of this convention. And it's interesting, the Convention of States people, that's the group founded by Mark Meckler that works with Wolfpack and others, they're telling us that Congress will not correct itself. They're the main reason we need to have an Article 5 convention, and that's in Congress. Not only may they try to make laws about the convention, but they may also serve as delegates.
Well, indeed, and they'll probably feel that they're the best qualified people. They have some of the highest profiles in state politics and connections and funding. I suspect we'll see quite a few of them. And I have to say, I have like Mark Meckler as a person, and I've talked with him about this, and he's admitted that in order to have the convention move efficiently, it very likely will be full of state legislators because they know Robert's Rules of Orders and all that sort of thing. So I don't think that they have any serious expectation that this really will be a convention of the people. I think it'll be a convention of the state legislators, and that's sort of implied in the name of their organization as well. And people you don't like in Congress, a great many of them used to be in the state legislature. It's not
that
these are two different breeds.
It's almost like the AAA minor leagues of the of Congress, you know, the next step.
You said it, I didn't.
I've been obviously doing a little research on Mr. Meckler, and he belongs to a group called Living Room Conversations, and there's a website. And he made a very remarkable quote, and it's still, the last time I checked, it was still there. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll just paraphrase it. He's trying to build consensus with Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives. That's all well and good. And he said the problem, he said, isn't the parties. It's the elites that run both D.C. and the state capitals. And, you know, I show this to supporters and I said, look, he's making a wonderful case against an Article 5 convention. If he believes there are elites that run the state capitals, why would you want these same elites running an Article 5 convention? You know, so he doesn't say that when he testifies in front of a committee at New Hampshire, or he travels around the country testifying to people that that support it. They have the former senator from Oklahoma was the last one that testified in New Hampshire. I have a mental block here. Former senator, and he's a very likable guy. You know who I'm talking about? Almost had his name, Senator. He's a doctor, medical doctor. Tom Colburn.
Yeah.
It was interesting too. He testified last, and you can't refute his testimony. And I didn't quite know what he was going to say. That's the first time I heard him. But afterwards, I went up to him very politely, and again, he's a likable guy, unlike Mr. Mike Farris, who's easy to dislike as his temperament. I said, you voted for the. I asked him about. Oh, he said that we have two constitutions. That's one of the arguments. We have the one that, you know, from 1787. Then we have one that the annotated constitution, full of Supreme Court decisions and this and that and opinions. So I asked him, I said, Senator, which constitution did you use when you voted for the Bush bailout? And I thought, I thought he'd get really upset. And he said, I was wrong to make that vote. I made a mistake. And I tell people, look, here's this. I would say an honorable man that was sent to D.C. not to do this. And it wasn't, I mean, that was a $1 trillion vote. That was the most important vote he probably ever made. And he failed us. Would you trust him at an Article 5 convention? A guy of his caliber, an honorable man, still blew it. You know, so he kind of scratched their head. You know, it's like, yeah. And it's like when my wife had an operation a few years back. And we learned, you know, we knew the doctors involved. We knew the procedure, the pros and cons. Article 5 convention is basically rolling the Constitution into an operating room, and we don't know who these doctors are. We don't know how, you know, are they qualified? We have no idea. We don't know the procedures yet, and this is supposed to be the panacea. It's going to bring our nation back to its, back to restore it. Oh, we're running out of time. This half hour goes pretty quickly. First, thank you very much for being a guest. And second, where can people get a hold of you or your writings on this subject?
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a very nice conversation. I'm on the faculty at Georgetown Law School, so they can write to me at david.super@law.georgetown.edu or write to me just regular mail at Georgetown. I've published op-eds on this in several places, including The Hill, The Los Angeles Times, and The Denver Post.
So you can just find those links. And when I upload this video, I'll put a link to your article that you did in the post. Well, thank you very much, Professor, and thank you, folks, for listening. And until next week, may God bless you. You've been listening to Hal Shirtless, Camp Constitution Radio on WBCQ The Planet.
Thank you.